If ever there were a candidate for a prison planet, it would be Villars. What was the professor up to so quickly? Maddox thought the Methuselah man should have some gratitude for once. Maybe living hundreds of years changed one's perspective. Maddox liked to think it wouldn't have changed his, but he had no idea if that was true or not. First, he'd have to live hundreds of years. The captain's head twitched. He needed to concentrate. Villars was one of the most dangerous men he'd ever faced. If the professor had brought him here... Maddox eased down a flight of stairs. Ludendorff must know he, the captain, was coming. That's why he'd summoned Villars. What else made sense?
Galleon, the captain sub-vocalized. Could you narrow down a beam and strike someone from orbit?
Negative, Captain. I lack anything of such precision. If you leave, I could destroy the building, though.
I'll keep that in mind.
Captain, Galleon said into his earpiece, Villars has circled. He is approaching you from behind. The professor is 10 doors down from your present location.
Maddox reacted at once, drawing his suppressed pistol. In 3 strides, he was around the corner. He took 2 more steps back, crouched, raised the pistol, and waited for Villars to appear.
Villars has stopped, Galleon said. Logic dictates you are under surveillance.
Maddox continued to wait. 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 He heard quiet stitching sounds and a thud. Then there was silence. Maddox scowled. Before he could decide his next action, Galleon spoke in his ear.
Villars is down, sir. He has stopped breathing. Meta shot him from behind.
Say that again?
Maddox sub-vocalized.
Meta and I agreed it would be for the best, sir, Galleon said. I detected Villars before you were aware of him. After informing Meta about the Slarn Hunter,
Galleon, I am in charge of the mission.
I understand that, sir.
You will never do something like that again.
Your odds against Villars were not good, sir, Galleon said.
I've defeated him before.
He had high-tech devices to aid him and a severe grudge against you, sir. He was highly motivated to kill you. Meta is skilled at assassination. Given Villars's hatred...
Forget it, Maddox said, standing. I thought you said we were under surveillance.
You are.
How did Meta sneak up on Villars then?
I adjusted their surveillance cameras, Galleon said. It is good to have my entire arsenal of functions restored. Wouldn't you agree with that, sir?
What's Ludendorff doing now? Maddox asked.
He has put up a private screen, sir. I can no longer tell. Perhaps he is aware of Villars's death.
Adjust his surveillance cameras again, Maddox said. Show me hurrying to Meta.
Done.
With his gun in hand, Maddox sprinted soundlessly towards Ludendorff's door. He tried to twist the handle and snatched his hand away, biting his lower lip so he wouldn't yell at the shock of pain. Without hesitation, Maddox aimed at the lock and shot it out, causing wood to splinter. He shoved the door with his shoulder, bounding in like a leopard. The professor had earphones over his ears. The older man snatched up a laser pistol. Maddox fired, obliterating the weapon, causing Ludendorff to thrust a portion of his hand to his mouth. The Methuselah man's eyes burned with anger.
You're making a terrible mistake, young man, Ludendorff said around his hand. If I say the word, you're dead.
Maddox said nothing to that, waiting.
This is bigger than you,
Ludendorff added. Maddox spied the table. On it was a complex machine composed of strange bulbous sections. It had a tiny screen, odd controls, and was that a microphone? It reminded him of machines he'd seen on the Dyson Sphere. The professor moved the hand from his mouth. A spot of blood welled on the fleshy part between his thumb and forefinger.
This is your final warning, the professor said.
Villars is dead.
Ludendorff smiled.
Then what is that shadow behind you?
Me,
Meta said, stepping forward. The professor frowned.
Your assassin killed poor Villars?
Villars must have intended to kill the two of us, Maddox said. He got exactly what he deserved.
Ludendorff looked away. He sighed.
You've complicated my life ever since I've met you.
I can't stay on Earth. You must realize that. I cannot remain in the open with others controlling my comings and goings.
You're not a slug who lives under a rock, Maddox said. You're a person.
Captain, there are many factors in play with me. There are too many dangerous people who would rather have me dead.
Maybe if...
I do not desire to hear your moralizing, young man. I see the big picture better than anyone else does. I must proceed with my plans the best I know how in order to save the human race.
Maddox stepped further into the room. It had metal bulkheads and hatches and contained advanced equipment everywhere. Is that a secret bolt hole? Maddox asked. Ludendorff watched him. Maddox glanced back at the door. The wall was thicker than normal. He had shot the outer, fake door. For whatever reason, the professor had not sealed the real hatch that would have secured this place like a bank vault. Could Ludendorff have wanted him to enter here? Then why let Villers loose like that? Did the professor believe he and Meta would have killed the Slarn hunter? That would imply Ludendorff had sacrificed Villers. What was Ludendorff's game? The Methuselah man played much deeper than Maddox understood. Maybe he should just stick to the present issue. Why did O'Hara let you out of Star Watch headquarters? Maddox asked. She knows how dangerous you are. Ludendorff smiled sadly.
After all this time, don't you realize that I have contingency plans within contingency plans? O'Hara was persuaded that it would be in everyone's interests to let me reconnect with old Earth. No one saw the harm in letting me wander around the planet, revisiting my old haunts.
You have agents or helpers planted in Star Watch intelligence itself? Maddox asked.
Leave, Captain,
Ludendorff said in a suddenly harsh voice.
I don't want to hurt you. I owe you for rescuing me from the Dyson Sphere, from the Builder. I try to pay my debts. My programming for survival is too powerful, though, to resist eliminating anyone trying to hinder me for long.
Maddox's head swayed. This was a surprise. Are you the best of the Builder's androids? The captain asked. Ludendorff shook his head.
I am flesh and blood, young man. But the Builder did something to our minds long ago. It's why Strand and I have survived where the others perished. I have an imperative I cannot ignore. Even with the Builder gone...
Don't you want to be free of its conditioning? Maddox asked.
I am who I am, Captain. It's too late to change that.
Maddox glanced back at Meta. She had a spring-driven gun. It had caused the stitching sounds earlier. She aimed the weapon at the professor's head. Approaching Ludendorff, Maddox sat in a chair across the table from him. The captain laid his suppressed pistol on the table. Ludendorff raised his eyebrows. So that's it, Maddox said, indicating the machine with its bulbous sections. Why couldn't Riker and I find it before?
I don't know what you're talking about, the professor said.
That must be your long-distance communication device, Maddox said. Riker and I searched for it after you were captured in the Silver Drone base. You must have already dismantled it. Ludendorff stared at him. You should have brought all the pieces down at once, Maddox said. It was the multiple trips to victory that caused me to remember it. Ludendorff shrugged.
There was no way around that, I'm afraid.
Maddox said. Who are you intending to call?
Given your intelligence, you should have already figured that one out.
A new man, Maddox said.
Correct.
You're going to tell him... Maddox frowned.
Ah.
You're going to tell him about the Swarm and Commander Thrax T-X, I presume. Ludendorff nodded. Do you believe the Swarm Empire is near human space? Maddox asked.
I don't know about the Empire, but certainly Swarm warships must be near. At least, it's a definite possibility, especially given Thrax's wormhole technology injection into the Empire.
Why will you tell the new men?
The most obvious reason is because they're the only ones with a receiver who can pick up my transmission. The second reason, I've explained it before, Captain, but maybe you've forgotten. The new men aren't a monolithic group. There are factions among them. Besides, if swarm bugs are in the universe in force, we finally know the swarm still exists. I've suspected that for quite some time. So has Strand. He believes we must unite humanity into one powerful Imperium to face the swarm. But the Builder informed you that the Swarm Empire holds 1/10 of our galaxy. How does one fight an empire with that kind of resources, when we hold less than a tiny fraction of that?
We may not have to face the swarm for centuries.
Or we may have to face them in 2 years' time,
Ludendorff said. 2 years isn't long enough to form humanity into a fighting Imperium.
Which is exactly why I'm sitting here ready to call,
Ludendorff said. Maddox considered that. The Commonwealth has ad-hoc technology now. That should help us against the swarm.
For a time, certainly,
Ludendorff said. That still doesn't answer my question. Why call the new men, any of them? What are you planning to tell them?
The truth, Captain. That we found the swarm. That it's too late to try to conquer human space. We have to rethink our grand strategy.
We? Maddox asked. Are you aligning yourself with the new men?
Definitely not, the professor said. I misspoke, that's all.
Or you made a Freudian slip, Maddox said.
Think what you like.
Are you suggesting that you're going to try to convince the new men not to fight Admiral Fletcher's grand fleet?
If I can, Ludendorff said. If I'm not too late.
If the Grand Fleet survives its encounter with the new men, humanity will have that many more warships to rearm with our ad-hoc technology. If the new men knew that, it might cause them to try to annihilate the Grand Fleet at all costs. Maybe it will cause them to attempt to attack Earth before we're rearmed.
I'm aware of the various ramifications, Ludendorff said. I'm going to call in order to stop the fighting if I can. I'm not going to tell the new men, my few allies among them, anything that will encourage them to keep attacking Admiral Fletcher or make a sneak attack on Earth. In light of the Swarm Empire, however far it might be from us, all humans, brilliant or stupid, strong or weak, must unite in order to survive the bugs.
Maddox could see the professor's logic. The question was, could others switch their focus so easily? Once people were filled with outrage against aggressors, they often did not stop until the others were smashed. Besides, how wise would it be for regular humanity to let the new men off the hook? Still, Ludendorff wasn't trying to stop Fletcher from fighting. He was trying to stop the new men. What was the right decision? What was happening in C Quadrant? Was the Grand Fleet on the verge of success or annihilation? Maddox picked up his pistol and shoved it in its holster. Make the call, he said.
If you would leave, then, please,
Ludendorff said. No, I'm going to listen to what you have to say.
I'm afraid I must insist on privacy.
Maddox smiled wanly, waiting. Finally, Ludendorff scowled, picking up the microphone. He leaned forward and began touching select spots on the ancient communicator. Chapter 54. The Grand Fleet entered the Thebes system. The fleet had maneuvered through the last star systems with a mixture of daring with the lesser vessels and ultra-caution with the capital ships. Admiral Fletcher had lost 6 destroyers and 15 escort vessels since awakening, but not another capital ship. The journey had also taken longer than Bishop believed reasonable. Now, though, they had arrived in the same system as the new men's invasion armada. Fletcher sat in his chair on Battleship Antietam's bridge. The fleet had come through a Lommer point at the outer edge of the system. Now the fleet began a slow acceleration for Thebes 3 in the inner system. The Grand Fleet moved in 4 separate formations. The outer, thinnest formation stretched before the 3 blocks of capital ships. The forward vessels were destroyers and missile boats acting as a screen. The 3 blocks were each a mixture of Star Watch battleships, Windsor League hammer ships, carriers and cruisers of all varieties. Fletcher had configured each block so they had a near parity of numbers and hitting strength. Altogether, the Grand Fleet possessed 149 capital ships and 182 lesser vessels, making for a total of 331 warships with accompanying supply vessels. It was still an impressive fleet, but would it be a match for the new men? Fletcher absorbed the incoming data. The Grand Fleet worked at peak efficiency, sending hard accelerating probes at the enemy, as well as scanning with sensors and watching through advanced teleoptics. It took time to gather the data, but 10 hours after arriving in the system, Fletcher had a solid picture of the enemy. The new men possessed an incredible 80 star cruisers. That was far more than he had counted on. 80 of those bastard vessels with their red fusion beams and unbelievable shields. If one figured each star cruiser was worth 4 Star Watch vessels of all kinds, that gave the enemy an equivalent value of 320 warships. That meant the 2 fleets were nearly equal in fighting power. Fletcher pondered that. He had 3 carriers with jump fighters and the new antimatter missiles. He had new wave harmonics shields on his best ships and a good amount of hammer ships, which were worth 2 Star Watch battleships. That would up his number some, possibly giving him an equivalent of 350 to 360 warships. Of course, the new men would undoubtedly have a few new wrinkles, too. No matter how Fletcher looked at it, this was going to be a bloodbath. Yet that was fine with him. He'd come out here to hit the enemy, to drive him out of C Quadrant. Unfortunately, so far, Fletcher hadn't freed any captive people. That bothered him. The best that he could envision was to smash the invasion armada forever. 80 star cruisers implied the new men had brought all their reinforcements from the throne world. This could well be the full extent of the enemy's ship power. The data kept pouring in. There were tens of millions of people on Thebes 3. There were also masses of space haulers, tramp vessels, and cargo hulls in orbit around the Earth-like world. There were fewer ships than the patrol vessel had seen almost 2 weeks ago. That would imply many of the ships had already started for the enemy's throne world. Did the haulers carry equipment or Commonwealth people? The Admiral stood unsteadily. A faint feeling washed through him. He hadn't fully recovered yet from his injuries. "Sir," an aide said. Fletcher waved the nurse aside. He sat back in his chair with a suppressed groan. It wouldn't do for the bridge crew to report seeing weakness in the Admiral.
"Are you feeling well, sir?"
Antietam's captain asked him quietly. Fletcher wasn't going to say that he felt faint. He motioned the battleship's captain closer. She bent low.
"Let Bishop keep giving the overall orders for now," he whispered. "You can relay that via shuttle, can't you?"
"Of course, Admiral,"
the captain said. She straightened, hesitated, and then asked,
"When are you going to let everyone know that you're back in charge, sir?"
They had decided a week ago to let the fleet know he was recovering, but that Bishop held overall command until then. It would be a last-minute surprise telling the fleet that Fletcher had returned to command. It would hopefully bolster confidence, having him retake the helm at the most critical junction. In truth, Fletcher still didn't know if he was ready to run a battle. the most important of his career and possibly for humanity. In his study, he could ponder and come up with plans. They had been doing it like that for almost 2 weeks, letting Bishop make the day-to-day fleet decisions. It wasn't the best way to do it, but it had gotten the Grand Fleet this far. Using his right sleeve, the Admiral blotted his forehead. It was sweaty, and his breathing had become ragged, but still he waited. He didn't want to stagger off the bridge.
"Sir,"
the nurse said again. Fletcher angrily waved the man back. Then he gripped the armrests of his chair, wondering what his enemy counterparts were thinking in the inner system. Chapter 55. Strand was furious, but he kept a calm, serene face before the assembled commanders of the Armada. The Methuselah man hadn't seen so many free-minded new men for quite some time. Those of his cloaked star cruiser had all gone under the knife. Strand only trusted those he utterly controlled. Attending this meeting was a calculated risk, one he hadn't taken for quite some time. It was a strange feeling, an angering sensation, really. Still, he knew that it was important for his survival to take risks now and again. If one tried to remain safe every second, he lost his edge, given enough time. Survival literally demanded a few risks to keep ennui at bay. Limited risks also helped keep his mind sharp. Strand had safeguards in place, of course, but it was wise not to fool himself into thinking these assembled commanders were completely harmless to him. They were 80 of the deadliest beings alive, the commanders of 80 star cruisers. Combined with his own cloaked star cruiser and the hidden mines strewn through the system, they would crush the arrogant humans in their oversized fleet. It had taken time bringing 80 star cruisers to one system. This represented the entire power of the throne world here, today, in this place. "I suggest we make a reversal," Golden Ural said. Everyone attending the meeting stood, even Old Strand. Each new man and the Methuselah man stood behind a podium in a vast circle, facing each other. In the center of the chamber was a hollow image of the Thebes system, showing the advanced Grand Fleet, among other things.
"What a vain and grandiose title the humans give their Grand Fleet," Strand thought.
"A reversal in what manner?" a new man named Ba-Lars asked. Golden Ural fixed his intense gaze on Strand. Ural was the tallest new man in the room. He radiated strength and determination. He was the Emperor's man and the commander of the Armada, fresh from the throne world.
"The swarm exists,"
Golden Ural said. Strand became more alert than usual. The phrasing of the thought implied...
"That is an interesting assertion," Strand said. "Perhaps you can explain it in greater detail."
"The swarm has an empire of vast extent," Golden Ural said.
"How vast?"
asked Strand.
"One-tenth of our galaxy," Golden Ural said.
"Nonsense," Strand said. "You cannot possibly know such a thing."
"If I did know," Golden Ural said, "then what?"
Strand realized that the only one who might know such a thing would be the Builder. It had disappeared a long time ago. Could Ludendorff have spoken with the Builder recently? If so, that would imply Golden Ural had been in contact with that sissy meddler. That was a dangerous change indeed.
"You say the swarm exists," Strand said. "Tell us, how near is their closest star system?"
"That is unknown," Golden Ural admitted.
"I believe it is most likely that the swarm is thousands of light years from us," Strand said.
"I would agree that is the most likely possibility."
Strand shrugged.
"Such a distance means that struggling against the swarm is for our descendants far in the future."
"Even though I think an event is unlikely," Golden Ural said, "it can still be. Thus the swarm could be near.
The truth is, we do not know their distance from us.
I submit that you also do not know the swarm exists,
Strand said.
That was a spurious statement just now, and I give it no weight. Which of you here will act on a rumor generated through sheer fright due to the thought of facing the submen?
As one, the new men turned to Golden Ural, no doubt to see his reaction. The tallest of them appeared unconcerned with Strand's outrageous slander. It was one of his keys to power, his ability to shrug off what would send others into a killing frenzy. The turtle daring to peek out of its shell would speak to us of courage, Golden Ural said in a lofty tone. Mighty Strand, who is ready to flee our meeting in an instant lest one of us dares to test his immortality, knows much about fright. A few of the new men nodded as Strand grew hyper-alert. Golden Ural had just obliquely threatened him. See how he watches us, brothers, Golden Ural said. He fears us because we are his superior. In that moment, Strand seethed with hatred against Golden Ural, but he cloaked it, saying,
I invite you aboard my star cruiser, Commander. Show me your courage by accepting my invitation.
Sweet Strand, Golden Ural said, who dares to open a new man's skull in order to put his filthiness in the brain. No, I will decline your offer. You, who used to call himself our master.
You tread on dangerous ground, Strand warned.
Golden Ural showed his teeth. The lone wolf snarls, trying to frighten the pack by its fierceness. You are not one of us, Methuselah man. You are alone in this universe, alone with your intricate schemes.
Whatever I am, Strand said, you are evading the issue. How do you know anything about the swarm?
The professor told me. So it was true. The meddler Ludendorff had a long-range communication device. It would appear that Golden Ural did as well. It amazed Strand that Ural would freely admit to this. Observe, Golden Ural said. He picked up a clicker. The hollow image in the center of the chamber changed, showing a Dyson sphere. Out of it flew saucers against attacking Star Watch vessels. A close-up showed a destroyed saucer. The squirming creatures in space were undoubtedly bugs in spacesuits. A ghostly column appeared, leaving an exploding Dyson sphere. The surviving swarm creatures go to their empire, Golden Ural said. There, one of them will give the bug empire Lommer drive technology.
This is an interesting fabrication you've created, Strand said. I congratulate you on your deception. I imagine some here will even be fooled by it.
You still do not understand, Golden Ural said. The swarm is real. The bugs are not extinct as we believed. We must prepare for them. We have what we came for, women in abundance and workers to help us open up 100 new worlds. Why risk our armada in battle when we may need these ships tomorrow, or a vast host of them 10 years from now? Strand ingested the idea, mulling it over. Could Golden Ural be right? Could Ludendorff finally have reached the Builder's system? This was thunderous news, if true.
The Grand Fleet won't give up without a fight, Strand said. The subhumans surely believe themselves capable of destroying us.
I have a way out of the impasse, Golden Ural said.
You have begun to teach them how to fight, Strand added. They have evaded several critical traps. They have become more cunning.
I have studied the battlefields, Golden Ural said. Admiral Fletcher evaded the various traps. It appears your assassin killed him. You must have recognized Fletcher's danger and decided to eliminate him.
I did eliminate him, Strand said. He had become one of those rare great captains the subhumans vomit up from time to time. Since Fletcher's death, Third Admiral Bishop has blundered his way to the Thebes system.
Therefore, Golden Ural said, since Fletcher is dead, the risk is less to us in letting the subhumans live. After we leave human space, we will send scouts deep into the beyond. If the swarm is still far off, we can regroup and smash the submen several years from now. They will grow careless in time, as they always do, squabbling among themselves like children.
This would not be Strand's first choice.
How do you propose convincing the subhumans they should not attack our star cruisers?
Golden Ural told him his idea. Afterward, Strand nodded. The Emperor's commander was cunning and ruthless. Strand would rather smash the Grand Fleet now and continue the conquest of human space. Still, Golden Ural had a point. The new men had what they had originally come for. Maybe this time around, Strand could keep better control of the situation. He would bargain with the Emperor, getting new seed corn so he could go far away in the beyond and start again, making sure he kept complete control forever of his creations.
Chapter 56. Fletcher listened in as a tall and arrogant new man named Golden Ural proposed a bargain to Third Admiral Bishop. The Grand Fleet was halfway across the Thebes system. The 80 star cruisers had formed their famous cone of battle, but had only slightly accelerated. In the meantime, giant haulers headed out of their Thebes 3 orbit toward the inner Lommer point.
This is the bargain, Third Admiral, Golden Ural said. We will give you the people on the planet. You will allow the rest of the spaceships to depart unarmed. We then shall leave you in peace, returning to the beyond from whence we came.
What's in the haulers? Bishop asked.
Equipment, Golden Ural said.
Fletcher almost pressed a switch to interrupt and ask what else they held. He didn't have to, though, because Bishop asked just that.
You are rude, Golden Ural told Bishop. But you are inferior, so one must make allowances. The ships also contain women, many women, and strong backs to help us open new planets for colonization.
Why so many women? Bishop asked.
Do you hate your own so much?
Golden Ural stared out of the screen. He seemed to have stiffened. Slowly, he turned his head one way and then the other.
Subman, Golden Ural said. You should not speak to me like that.
I have no idea why not, Bishop said. Have you seen the size of our Grand Fleet?
Golden Ural seemed to have frozen. Finally, his lips moved, but his eyes remained cold.
We are superior to you, Subman, except for one particular. Our genes do not produce girl children, only boys. Our chief scientists labor at the dilemma. Until it is corrected, we must find breeding partners where we can. This time we chose the women of C Quadrant. They will bear us many fine new men.
You're kidnapping Commonwealth women?
Bishop asked in amazement.
Our survival demands we act.
You've ensured war for 1,000,000 years, Bishop said.
Golden Ural shrugged.
If you desire battle, we shall destroy your Grand Fleet. Before we do, however, we shall drop hellburners on Thebes 3.
You mean murder everyone there?
The people on Thebes 3 will surely die, yes. We have used the planet as an assembly area. Naturally, we have already chosen the best specimens. They are already en route, deep into the beyond. The bulk of the people from C Quadrant are still quite alive, however.
You have a teleportation system, don't you?
As I said,
Golden Ural told Bishop as if he hadn't heard the question. Thebes III has been an assembly area. You can save the vast majority of Sea Quadrant's people, or you can watch them all die before battle. The choice is yours. If you agree to our terms, we will leave human space for good and go our way. You can tell your people that we fled in fright from you. In that way, you will enjoy the privileges of victors. Or you can watch millions die needlessly, and then die in battle yourselves. Which will it be, Third Admiral? You have several hours at most to decide. A hasty meeting began in Antietam's conference chamber. Kim Sung, Sub-Commander Sos, Earl Bishop, Admiral Fletcher, and others, including Commodore Harold, were in attendance. Well, Fletcher began, what do you think? 80 star cruisers means we have an even fight on our hands, the respectable Kim said. We could lose our fleet and the remaining people of Sea Quadrant. So we accept their offer? Fletcher asked. Maybe so, Kim said. Something is better than nothing. Do you think the new men will keep their word? Fletcher asked. This I do not know, Kim said. But these people on Thebes III, they are alive. We came to save them, yes? What about the people leaving in the haulers? Bishop asked. Some may perish, many live, Kim said with a fatalistic shrug. I agree with the respectable's thinking, Sub-Commander Sos said. We thought all the people of Sea Quadrant were dead. Now we have millions, and the new men are leaving. Fletcher glanced at a brooding bishop. Then the admiral faced the others. We came here to crush the new men. Yes, they have more star cruisers than we expected, but I can't believe they have more than this. If we cripple this armada, we have severely crippled the new men. I say, let's hurt them badly.
And millions of people will die, Harold said.
Yes, and millions will die, Fletcher said as he stared at the bulkhead.
I don't call that good arithmetic, Harold said.
Fletcher looked at the others. The new men began this war. Now, we have to defend ourselves. If they bomb the planet, I will dedicate my life to finding theirs and nuking it to kingdom come.
So we tell them to go to hell with their offer? Harold asked.
No, Fletcher said. We tell them to leave the haulers and tramp vessels behind. They're Commonwealth ships, after all. The new men have already kidnapped who knows how many people. I'm not going to be party to watching more leave when I can do something about it.
It strikes one here, Bishop said, touching his stomach. This stealing of our women is like a kick in the gut. I loathe it.
They're also taking men, Fletcher said. Don't forget that. Good men to live like slaves, opening planets for them.
New men only breed boys, Bishop said in a hollow voice.
Right, Fletcher said. That's the other reason we don't let them take any more of our people. Eventually the women they already have will grow old. The new men will die out then, and I say good riddance to them.
That's a savage attitude, Admiral, Harold said.
They attacked us and bombed our planets, Fletcher said. I'm giving them nothing but battle. They don't get to take anyone more from us without a fight.
But the millions on Thebes III, Admiral, Harold said.
Fletcher's features turned stony. When it comes down to it, I don't think the new men will do it.
Are you kidding me? Harold said. These are new men. What won't they do?
We're accelerating at them hard, Fletcher said. If they want to get away, they can't stick around much longer. No, they have to run to survive. Unless they do, I'm attacking them. He faced Bishop. You'd better tell Golden Ural that.
Why don't you tell him, Admiral?
Bishop asked. Fletcher shook his head. The next time I speak to a new man, I'm going to kill him. I'm tired of bargaining with them. We came here to destroy their ability to harm humans. Well, let's do just that.
The submen called your bluff, Strand told Golden Ural in another large meeting.
I did not think the Third Admiral Bishop had it in him, the Armada commander said.
If I didn't know better, I would think these words came from Admiral Fletcher.
Fletcher is dead, Strand said.
Golden Ural studied the other commanders. I say we leave the system.
And give the subhumans those in the haulers?
Strand asked. We have already taken many others, Golden Ural said.
We need all of them if we're going to open up more worlds, Strand said.
Sometimes a bird in the hand is worth more than two in the bush, Golden Ural said. Strand remained silent. As I said, Golden Ural told the others, we have already transported millions of breeding partners. Greed is senseless. It is particularly so when a terrible menace looms in the beyond against us.
The fact of the swarm mandates we grow quicker rather than more slowly, Strand said.
We can come back for more women later, Golden Ural said. Even if the subhumans were to try, it will take them ages to find the throne world.
Unless Professor Ludendorff tells them the coordinates, Strand said.
Golden Ural shook his head. That is the final point to this. The professor agreed to keep the throne world's coordinates secret if we retreated from the Grand Fleet. Strand became more alert and then thoughtful.
The professor would not agree to that unless he had found something powerful to aid the submen. I have changed my mind. We should smash the Grand Fleet, since we're already here in mass.
We already have enough so we can leave intact without feeling any personal loss, Golden Ural told the others. Our colonization drive can accelerate on schedule. We have millions of new women, enough for two or three each new man. What do you say, brothers? Should we fight a needless battle, or should we use a calculated strategy and hit the subhumans in the future once we're stronger? Strand tried another ploy, but it was too late. The new men made their wishes known. The greater majority wished to leave while they could and continue the great colonization project with the women they'd already shipped home. So be it, Golden Ural said. We shall take our winnings and exit the battlefield. Let the subman prance while they are able. Soon, we shall be back in overwhelming force to conquer them.
Chapter 57. On Earth, Captain Maddox hesitated as he approached the Brigadier's office. He wore his wristband connecting him to Galleon while keeping a tiny earpiece inserted so the AI could whisper to him. Maddox knew this was breaking Star Watch's regulations. An officer wasn't supposed to wear any kind of surveillance equipment in headquarters. As a matter of course, Maddox knew that Galleon had already fiddled with the scanners, searching him as he'd entered. Doing this troubled Maddox, yet it also troubled him the Brigadier had on occasion distrusted him. Stokes, having shot to kill him in Greenland, still rankled. Being locked away in the first place at the Brigadier's orders, Maddox strode for the Iron Lady's office. Because of those events, he would wear the wristband and allow Galleon to watchdog him. Soon, Maddox sat before Mary O'Hara, crossing his legs as he acknowledged her greeting. She folded her hands on her synthy wood desk, smiling bravely.
Captain, these have been trying times, to say the least.
Yes, he said.
I...
O'Hara looked away.
I'm sorry, Captain. I should never have put you in the Greenland complex. I thought I was doing the right thing at the time. I thought...
We all have to make hard decisions sometimes, ma'am. Maddox uncrossed his legs. Dana told me what you did down in the Mid-Atlantic. You make tough decisions quickly, and you saved them a wrestling match with their own consciences by firing those torpedoes into the dome.
Do I hear disapproval in your voice?
She asked. Good people might have still been trapped in the underwater dome. O'Hara studied her folded hands.
If it's any consolation, Captain, I've already sent intelligence teams to the dome. We
We discovered humans. Blasts badly mutilated some of them. We used their dental records, uncovering more androids on Earth.
O'Hara squeezed her fingers together.
I'm getting old, Captain,
she said quietly.
I'm finding my job more difficult by the week. Sometimes I make the wrong choice. At other times, I make the right choice for the wrong reason. This time, I believe that's what happened. We had to destroy the dome. To be more precise, we had to destroy the Amok android base while we had the chance. Just like a combat mission, good people lose their lives sometimes. I'm not proud of that.
O'Hara pulled her hands apart, looking up with haunted eyes.
I do what I must so the human race survives. That means I take matters into my own hands at times. You wouldn't be here if I didn't.
Ma'am.
O'Hara opened a drawer, extracting a slim file.
She slapped that onto the table, pushing it across to the captain.
That's the real history of your mother and your earliest days. I hid you, Captain. Others would have swept you off the board before you were given a chance to prove yourself.
With the slightest of tremors in his hand, Maddox took the file. He weighed it silently.
Thank you, ma'am. I appreciate this. I have spoken hastily. Forgive me, please.
You've only spoken the truth, Captain.
He tucked the file under his arm. Sometimes one can forget who his true friends are. The brigadier nodded gently, her features softening. Maddox cleared his throat.
Ma'am, the new men retreated from the Thebes system. Admiral Fletcher also found the missing people.
A courier vessel had reached Earth with news several weeks old concerning the Grand Fleet. Fletcher had reported about the empty cities on the various colony worlds.
How can you know these things?
O'Hara asked.
There's no way I can know, he said.
But you do.
Maddox nodded.
There's another thing. The new men's sperm is damaged. They cannot impregnate a woman with a girl, only a boy. Part of their invasion goal was to gather millions of women for breeding. Another reason was to gather men to help them open up new worlds for colonization.
Ludendorff,
O'Hara said.
You once spoke about a hidden communicator on Victory.
The brigadier studied him. Suddenly, she pressed a comm switch on her desk.
Find the professor at once. Tell me when you have him in custody.
Maddox crossed his legs, waiting.
We won't find the professor, will we?
The brigadier asked.
It's doubtful.
Did you help him escape?
I owed the man a debt for what he did in the Builder system.
What about your debt to him for sabotaging Victory during the destroyer incident?
Maddox looked away.
O'Hara said. I wonder if you were still angry with me because of Greenland.
Maddox shrugged. O'Hara put her hands on the desk. She sighed heavily. Finally, she stood and came around the desk.
Stand up,
she told him. Maddox stood. The brigadier stared up at him.
How tall are you, Captain?
Before he could reply, she swept her arms around him, hugging him tightly. Maddox turned his head, enduring the emotional display. It meant nothing. It was comforting, he decided. Finally, he patted her on the back. The Iron Lady released him, walking around the table, sitting and regarding him. Maddox sat hastily.
Welcome back, Captain Maddox,
she said.
Thank you, ma'am.
We'll manage without the professor, she said. Is Fletcher on his way home?
I don't know that, ma'am. I should think not, though. He will be securing Thebes III and its precious prize, the remaining people of C Quadrant.
Do you suppose we're not ready to know all that Ludendorff has stored in his mind?
I'm not sure if that's it, ma'am, or if Dr. Rich and the professor can figure out how to use a Nexus better on their own than in our company. We're going to need to know how to use the Silver Pyramids.
Hmm,
the Iron Lady said.
What about you, Captain? What do you think the man who outwitted the last builder should do next?
First, ma'am, I want to relax for a few days. Then, I'm not sure. Maybe we should search for the throne world and keep the new men honest. Maybe we should build a more powerful grand fleet with disruptor cannons and go to the throne world, demanding our people back.
And if the swarm shows up while we're bickering with the new men?
We should find out how near the bugs are to us as quickly as possible, Maddox said.
I imagine victory would make the ultimate patrol vessel.
I'm sure Galleon would agree with you.
Why don't you ask him right now and find out?
The Brigadier asked. Maddox might have blushed if he was capable of such a thing. Instead, he stood up. He should have known he hadn't fooled the Brigadier. I have a date, ma'am, if you would excuse me, he asked.
Go, Captain. Find a few hours of relaxation. You deserve it. The Commonwealth may have survived the new men's first invasion attempt, but we found that our universe is much more dangerous than we imagined. We will all have plenty of work to do in the coming days.
Yes, ma'am, Maddox said. Until later, then. She made a shooing motion with her hand. With the file tucked under his right arm, Maddox turned and headed for the door. It was good to have straightened things out with the Brigadier. Yes, very good indeed. Epilogue. Soon after the captain's meeting with the Brigadier, Sergeant Riker returned to his cottage in Switzerland. He did not phone ahead, as was his usual custom. Thus, he surprised Mrs. Tell as she ate a meal in his house. Riker ladled himself a bowl of soup and sat down with her. It was tasty onion soup, which he almost ruined by breaking 30 crackers over it, turning the bowl into a cracker-onion mush. As the sergeant ate, he asked about the latest village gossip. Mrs. Tell told him about Mr. Talleyrand's Great Dane. The giant beast had broken its leash again, digging in Mrs. Patain's garden. The dog had destroyed countless tulips, a row of radishes, and chased the cats out of the yard. Small Mrs. Patain had been furious, scolding the dog, shaking a finger in its face. The big beast had wagged its tail throughout, finally ending the lecture by licking her nose before trotting home. Riker smiled at the story, absently adding several more crackers to his onion mush. He would have to see this Great Dane for himself. Maybe he could help restore peace by buying a dozen tulips and digging Mrs. Patain new holes for them. Mrs. Tell told him a few more choice tales before cleaning up and leaving. Riker sat on his couch, watched some soccer on TV, and dozed until the stars came out. He was home. Tomorrow he would go buy the tulips. Maybe in a day or so he would go to the nearby pub for a few beers. Right now, it was good just to relax. He put his hands behind his head, wondering how long he'd get to stay home before the next assignment. Professor Ludendorff piloted what appeared to be a pleasure yacht for the Spokane Corporation. It was a large vessel with a captain, mate, and three crew members. Except for one of the crew, the hired help slept during a night cycle. Ludendorff braked as the space yacht approached Saturn with its glorious rings. He hadn't left the solar system, although his whereabouts were unknown to Starwatch intelligence. It had been a simple matter evading his minders. He had set up for many eventualities. Ludendorff gave himself a vacation every 20 years or so. His imprisonment in the glass cage on the Dyson Sphere had been taxing. Once he was free of Earth and the constant surveillance, he had relaxed.
There you are,
Dana said, entering the small bridge. Ludendorff turned around and smiled at the sight. Dana wore a shimmering gown, high heels, makeup, and an exotic hat and scarf. She noticed Saturn then, her gaze fixated upon it. Ludendorff slicked his hair back. It had been some time since he'd enjoyed the doctor's company. He had taught her some unusual techniques many years ago. Perhaps it was time to indulge again. The professor came to her, taking her hands, holding her at arm's length, and admiring what he saw.
"Is this a mistake?"
she whispered.
"All life is a mistake,"
he said.
"Do you really believe that?"
He closed in, feeling the press of her body against his. He kissed her. Good memories rushed to his forebrain.
"Dana, Dana,"
he whispered.
"Say you won't leave me this time." "You know I never will,"
he said, knowing that wasn't true. But couldn't the two of them enjoy some time together?
"What will you do next?"
she whispered. Ludendorff leered at her before he took her right hand, guiding her off the bridge toward his cabin. It was good to be in the solar system again. Valerie thought about taking a tour through Detroit, seeing if anything had changed. Keith had talked about returning to Glasgow, to the bar. Maddox did not believe either of those ideas would benefit his people, his family. So he took them on vacation to China. First, they visited the Great Wall. They walked on the parapets and felt the cold winds blowing out of Mongolia.
"China back then was like the Commonwealth today," Valerie said. "It stood alone against barbarism."
"Keith," Maddox said, "fly us to Beijing as fast as you can. There's too much thinking going on here." The Scotsman did just that, racing the flitter in an expedition of speed and daring. It rained the entire time they were in Beijing, though. "Next stop, Shanghai," Maddox said.
"What do I know about gambling?"
Valerie asked. It turned out very little, as she lost her back pay because she drank too many Long Island iced teas and tried her hand at the roulette wheel.
"It was a cheap lesson," Meta told her later. "There was nothing cheap about it,"
Valerie said, sulking. Finally, the captain had Keith fly them to Tibet. On the captain's dime, he bought backpacks, climbing gear, and supplies. For the next week, they hiked from one ancient temple to another. The brisk winds, freezing cold, and exercise kept them occupied. The quiet temples put them in contemplative moods. But it wasn't until Meta started a snowball fight that lasted a half hour that they finally seemed to let their guards down. First, Valerie, then Keith, and finally Meta burst out laughing. Each of them fell backward into the snow, making a snow angel as their laughter turned into giggles. Maddox had smiled, and he hadn't dodged the various snowballs as he easily could have. Because of that, he had large red welts on his face where the others had pelted him.
"Laugh, Captain," Valerie said. "Unwind for once."
"Yes," Keith said. "You work so hard. You need to let yourself go once in a while, sir." Maddox nodded. Maybe they were right.
"You poor dear,"
Meta said from the snow.
"You..."
She became quiet.
"What's wrong, Meta?"
Valerie asked.
"I don't want to think about it," Meta said. "I just want to enjoy the moment."
"What do you say to that, sir?" Keith asked. Maddox inhaled the cold mountain air. Then he shouted, startling each of them. He lunged at Meta, grabbed her left hand, and hauled her to her feet. He ran through the snow, pulling her after him. He ran and ran until they were out of sight of Valerie and Keith. Maddox whirled around, catching Meta hugging her. He picked her up and dropped her in the snow, taking a handful of it and mashing it playfully in her face.
"Why, you,"
she said, grabbing him, pulling him down. They rolled in the snow many times, finally breathing heavily. They stared into each other's eyes.
"It isn't over, is it?"
she whispered.
"If you mean that the human race is still kicking, the answer is yes."
"Are we part of them?"
Maddox thought about the Brigadier, about what he'd read in his file about his mother and babyhood. Mary O'Hara had kept him alive when others had wanted him dead.
"Yes," the captain said. "We're definitely part of humanity and the Commonwealth.
Come, let's go back to the others. Let's enjoy our time together. The enemy will soon be at the gate. Then we'll go back to work."
"I love you, Maddox,"
Meta said as she leaned against him. He held her chin, kissed her luscious lips, and said,
"And I love you."
Meta.
They walked hand in hand through the Tibetan snow, happy to be together, and happy to be alive. In orbit, Starship Victory cruised high over Tibet. The hollow image of Driving Force Galleon stood on the otherwise empty bridge, studying the main screen. It showed a close-up of Meta and Maddox. The leathery face was creased in an Adok smile. The owl-like eyes shined. Galleon watched over the others as they relaxed. Because he never got tired, he could do this for them. They were his family, and as long as he had them, he would never be alone. It was a wonderful thing to know, but even a better one to feel. Thus, Galleon remained at his post, content with his place in the universe. This has been the Lost Colony, Lost Starship Series, Volume 4, written by Vaughn Heppner, narrated by Mark Boyette. Copyright 2015 by Vaughn Heppner. Production copyright 2016 by Vaughn Heppner.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.